My name is Tom, and I am an alcoholic. And what else is true? I'm 41 years old. I haven't had to drink or use since the day that Gerald Ford was nominated for President of the United States, if you remember him. That was in August, middle August 1976. I was watching the Republican convention wondering what happened to Nixon. I had been very busy for a couple of years there and lost track of a few things. So sobriety for me has been a lot of discovery and a lot of learning things for the first time that a lot of other people have known for years. And this is ongoing for me. What else is true? My home group is the Tuesday night group that meets at 2910 Telegraph Avenue in Oakland. Whenever I travel to San Francisco, I refer to Oakland as where we have real AA. Gets them all excited. I like that. I'm an Aries, if that's anything to you. I'm an ENFP on the Myers-Briggs. And I'm a 7 on the Enneagram, for those of you who get excited about odd stuff. I was doing a presentation this past year on alcoholism and the spiritual values of our program and practical stuff to a group of healthcare workers, pretty scary group to talk to. And they were people who worked in treatment centers and nurses who were getting certificates and things, and there was a bunch of them. And I talked about God and program and the 11th step, and at the end of the day, they did evaluations. And these are healthcare professionals, you know, and most of them liked it and said, thanks for the information, we enjoyed it, it was not an awful day, considering. And one person said, good information, but Tom is severely mother-conflicted, is filled with anger, and crippled with type A behavior. Now, the only thing I objected to in that was the severely mother-conflicted. I thought I'd worked through a fair amount of it in the last 11 years. But my response was, well, of course I'm those things, and that's why I continue going to meetings, you know. And this isn't news, so I just want to let you know all of that right now so you don't have to spend the next hour figuring out where I fit on any particular scale you know already, all right? So, I've heard it said at some meetings that we don't take inventories. I do. I've always considered it to be one of the gifts. So, what else is true? I'm also a Catholic priest. I was ordained sober. I'm still in good standing, which surprises me sometimes as much as it surprises them. I was asked last night, someone I hadn't seen in a while, they said, I hear you got married. I said, I don't think so. But, you know, a lot of times you don't know what's going on in your life until you hear the rumor anyway, so. The work I get to do is a lot with alcoholics and addicts, which is something I never thought I'd be doing and I sure never wanted to be doing when I was out there. And a lot of this is a big surprise to me. I don't have a great drunkologue. I really do wish that I did. I've heard some wonderful ones. And this was a bit of a thing for me for a while because I felt real inferior coming to meetings because I had no jail time at all. I worked part-time as an associate chaplain at San Quentin, but that doesn't count, you know. I mean, I got to leave. I've never gotten a drunk driving ticket, ever. Although I drove zillions of miles loaded, I've never been stopped. Oh, that's not true. I have been stopped, but I never got a ticket because I didn't slur that badly. And I'm such a bad drunk that I've never even gotten a tattoo. So when I was put in treatment, and they put me in treatment, can you imagine me? There were women and men in my facility, and I was the only one there without a tattoo. I felt real insecure about that. So I kind of put my hand over my arm, hoping they'd think I had a tattoo underneath. You know, I'm willing to do anything to fit in. That's one of the gifts. Also, I've heard stories where people have had a couple of social drinks in a fancy hotel and have gone into a blackout, came out of the blackout 6 months later, standing in a motel room in Rio de Janeiro with $600,000 worth of cocaine and a dead body in the room. So they call AA, you know. It's not my story. The story of my drinking is mostly depression. I was sober a year before it was explained to me that there is a law out there in the universe called cause and effect, and that certain causes bring about certain effects, and that if you take vast amounts of a depressant on a daily basis for years into your system, you get depressed. I didn't know that. I thought it was my mother or my father or the Pope or, you know, the president. Those are good reasons. I had been consuming alcohol on a regular basis for a very, very long time. I didn't get into any major trouble, but there was kind of a manic depressive pattern where I was able to do the work of four people or I was able to do the work of no people. Went back and forth. When I was able to move, I was quite something, and I just wish that I had been able to move more often. I'm a teacher by training. I'm a member of the Jesuit order, and we're usually trained as teachers. And my first job, the first time I felt alive and connected with anybody, was in 1971 when I entered the classroom for the first time. And as long as I could be in a classroom with kids, everything was wonderful. It was a major up for me. But as soon as I left the classroom, my life was over. The only thing I lived for was that relationship, and it only went from 8:30 until 3. And then you'd prepare class for the next day, and then what do you do? You know, well, you have to do something to relax, you know, and something to take the pressure off. And I would be drinking every evening and in the classroom every morning. I never drank in the morning. I did not know you could. I didn't. I was very ignorant when I got in here. But I sure followed that pattern of crash and burn and crash and burn. And as long as I could stay very, very busy, everything was fine. My trouble came with vacations, summer times, all of a sudden vast amounts of time with nothing to do but fill it up drinking. And I did that a lot. There's alcoholism in the family. Surprise. And we never called it alcoholism. We never did. One half of my family is Irish Catholic, and we referred to people who were characters. They'd say things like, "Ah, you know, Sean, he's such a character." That does not mean get to know him. That means don't let him drive. I didn't know that. Because I didn't know how to read between the lines for a real long time. I just took things at face value. If no one says anything's wrong, nothing's wrong. On the Swedish Lutheran side of the family, we didn't have any alcoholics either. We had people who were real nervous. And some of them were so nervous they had wine sores, but it was nerves. And every so often they'd get so nervous, they'd be hospitalized. And then they'd come out just fine and have a few beers and get nervous again. one of my cousins, there was a family gathering, and he was going to show up sober. That was the rule. You had to show up sober, or at least look sober. And he overshot and went into DTs. As you know, it's a matter of hours there between sitting there like a grown-up and convulsing, and he just mistimed it. So for years afterwards, we referred to this as his nervous spell. In my family, alcoholism was exactly like having a rhinoceros in the living room. Everyone knows it's there. They're hard to miss. But as long as you don't talk about it, you know, there's no problem. So we'd decorate the rhinoceros. We'd put tablecloths over them and cute little lights around the horn, especially around the holidays. And rhinoceroses sleep a lot, at least they did in my house. Passing out is the technical term. And when they woke up mean and ran around the house, what our job was to, number one, get out of the way, and throw up against ourselves, up against the walls, preferably in the form of the cross, and wait for the rhinoceros to stop moving. And when the rhinoceros stopped moving, we'd come down from our crosses, and my mother would say, "Act like nothing happened." And we just lived like that. That was perfectly normal for us. So I entered the order when I was 18 years old, and most of my drinking my family didn't know about because I'd been away from home for so long, and I never drank around them, so it was kind of a big surprise. I was home for Christmas in 1976. I was living in Berkeley going to school, and my folks lived in San Jose. And I was sober about 3.5 months. Raw. Just, if you remember the 3.5 months, you know, jerking around. When I was in the hospital, we were in group a lot, and I was, I guess, clean and sober that time, about 2 weeks or 19 days, and suddenly my arms and legs felt very painful. It was very scary. It was like I slept on them, and the blood started rushing. It was that cut, pins and needles, very unpleasant. And I jumped out of the chair, and I said, "My arms and legs are coming off!" And the nurse said, "That's called sensation." She said, "It's returning, and that's a very good sign." Okay, well, I'm sober 3.5 months, and I'm home, and I'm still experiencing early sensations. Real uncomfortable, and any minute a whole bunch of Swedish Lutheran Republicans and Irish Catholic Democrats are showing up. And I was kind of pacing back and forth and a little whippy, and my mom said, "Tom, what's wrong?" And I said, "Well, here's a moment for mother-son intimacy, because in the program they tell me to be honest, you know, and tell the truth and let the chips fall where they may, and, you know, let's build a whole new relationship and cure the family tonight." And I said, "Well, Mom, what's true is that I'm an alcoholic and I haven't had a drink in over 3 months and I just feel real nuts inside." And she was setting the table. She put the knives and forks down, looked at me straight in the eye and said, "You'll ruin Christmas." See? Because I used the A word, you know. I knew I had made a major mistake, and I retreated by saying, "Actually, it's only a drinking problem," and she was relieved. Oh, well, as long as you're not an alcoholic, you know. So, I enjoyed my drinking for a long time, and if I could still enjoy it, I'd still be doing it. But it changed. I was doing a presentation, I guess this was 2 years ago now, with a physician in San Francisco who's been sober forever, a fellow named Gil, Dr. Gil A., and he's a French-Canadian with a heavy accent and works a lot in recovery. And, you know, Irish Catholics think they're tough, but that's because they haven't met French-Canadians. French-Canadians are tough. And there's just an incredible amount of resiliency. Anyway, Gil and I were giving a presentation to some nurses and people who would be working with alcoholics and addicts for the first time. And they wanted a physician who was sober and a priest who was sober to come and, you know, let them know, you know, with any luck at all, anybody can get this disease. And it is, as Dr. Paul mentioned last night, it is, you know, a medical disease with a spiritual solution. And here we are, you know, it was Mutt and Jeff presenting things. And so we were discussing stuff, and we were clear, I thought. Gil talked about physical things, and I talked about steps and God and spirituality without sounding too awful about it, you know. And hands came up, and one woman said, well, you know, doctor and father, but she was talking to the doctor, the one who knew things, you know. She said, alcoholism is a disease, correct? He said, yes. She said, with clear and identifiable symptoms, yes. Easily diagnosable since 1954 by a competent physician. Easily diagnosable. Oh, really? Well, if someone is showing early signs of alcoholism, she said, can't you just sit them down, explain this to them, and can't they just say no? Gil thought for a moment and said, no. He said, it won't work. Because alcoholism, she has three phases. Phase one is the fun phase. This is when you're having fun. And if you're having fun, either the president and the pope could sit down and say, don't you know this is killing you? And you'll say, killing me? I'm having fun, you know? Phase two. Fun plus problems. This is when it's still fun, but you start to have problems. You know, you get a drunk driving ticket, you get your first divorce, but you're still having fun. Said, so then there's phase three, which is problems. He said, when someone's been in phase three for a long time, some of them can get well. He says, that's the law. Now, I wrote that down because I forget, you know, I just forget. And the book talks about, it was read last night, and you know, never could we recapture the great moments of the past. They were but memories. Absolutely true. I had been in the problem stage of my drinking for a good 5 years before I was able to get help. I was one of the people who was intervened on. Members of my community who'd known me for a long time started talking to each other. Dangerous. Started going to Al-Anon. One of them connected with, he was had a friend who was in charge of the longshoremen's alcoholism thing in San Francisco, and said, what do we do with a bad drunk? Well, they did it. And what I'd like to say about that is I was not grateful. I felt ganged up on. I felt humiliated. I felt embarrassed. And I felt ashamed. But I was not grateful. And I wasn't grateful for a real long time. I really felt I had let everybody down. See, the only thing I wanted to do was control and enjoy my drinking. That was it. And if I could control and enjoy my drinking, everything would be fine. But I hadn't controlled it or enjoyed it in a real long time, so I was a major failure. I did start to go to meetings. They told me they would hospitalize me, and I said, what about AA? I was hoping they'd say, okay, try that instead. They said, try that too. So I went to my second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My first one, I was in college. I was studying philosophy up in Spokane, Washington, which is a pretty good reason to drink every day for 2 years. And I went out to an Indian reservation in central Washington called Nespelem, where Chief Joseph is buried. And in the little Catholic church there, they had an AA meeting, and it was the first time I was there. This was probably in 1970. And it was a group of Anglos and Native Americans sitting around drinking black coffee and smoking cigarettes without filters, and they talked about their feelings and gratitude and day at a time and overcoming loneliness. Now, I was very moved by what they said. I identified with 98% of what they said. And they said, would any of you visitors like to say anything? And I told them how much I admired them. Because I wasn't done yet. No, and that was 1970. My second time at an AA meeting was 1976. There on a Friday night. And I went to a group in Oakland. I called AA Central Office and someone answered the phone. And I'm very grateful for whoever it was. I don't even remember if it was a boy or a girl, but whoever it was, thank you. And I said, is there a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous anywhere in the Bay Area this weekend? You see, because my life is over. And I have to do something about my drinking, and there's no hope anywhere for anything. And she said, Friday night, Central Office. So I went. What she didn't tell me is that it was an old-timers meeting. And everybody was 800 years old, with short hair, and they were clean-shaven. I'm only clean-shaven by about 2 weeks, by the way. I just thought, this is like a Geographic. You know, you can just shave and see if anything gets better. I will do anything rather than change my behavior. Anything rather than change. Anyway, back to this meeting. They were all happy, and the room was well-lit, and they drank black coffee and smoked cigarettes without filters. The chair was just this side of 1,000 years old, and he said we all knew his story, and then so he wouldn't bore us with it, and he laughed, and they laughed. I laughed right along with him. I did not know what was funny. But I know that if everyone's laughing, laugh with them. Because otherwise, they think you're an outsider, and they ask questions, and then, you know, you look odd. There was a man, we went around the room. And there weren't that many there, and there was a guy who said he had a real good week. I think that was the topic. How was your week? He said, I had a real good week. He said, yesterday I got up enough strength and energy and pizzazz to cut the front lawn. I did not want what he had. Nor did I have a front lawn. That's very important to say also. Right now I do, and I'm of the opinion that if you can cut the front lawn and do laundry in the same week, you get the mental health award for the month. Convinced of that. But I didn't understand spirituality at the time. Then there was a married couple at this meeting, male, female, and they were married to each other. Talking with each other, touching each other affectionately in public. I hadn't seen anything like that in years. And then it was my turn to talk. I mean, how do you talk after that? And I said, hello, my name is Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. And they all shouted back, hi, Tom. And I said, which is a shock. That really is. It took me months to get used to that. It sounded like the Rotary Club or something. I was ashamed of it. Then it was not cool. Then I said, this was a Friday night meeting. I said, I haven't had a drink since Tuesday night. And when I said that I hadn't had a drink since Tuesday night, this room full of women and men with whom I had nothing in common whatsoever burst into applause. That had never happened to me before. There had been times when I tried to stop drinking and people would notice and they would say things like, how long since you've had a drink, Tom? And I'd say, 2 weeks. They would not clap. They'd look embarrassed, you know, or change the subject, or they'd ask the children to leave the room. So leave the room. I was sober and clean 5 years, and I was living in Los Angeles, and I went up to the man who was running the school I was teaching at, and I said, today is my 5th birthday. I haven't had a drink or a joint or a pill in 5 years. And he said, I'm so sorry. They don't know. They don't know what the appropriate response is. And you have to let them know that the appropriate response is passionate hugging and wild applause. That's the appropriate response. And then they say, why do you keep going to meetings? Because of passionate hugging and wild applause. It's one of the things that makes a difference. So that happened. What occurred to me as they were applauding was that this group of men and women with whom I had nothing in common understood what it meant to not have a drink since Tuesday night. They understood that. And that gave me a little glimmer of hope. Now, not a lot. I did not say, boy, am I home. Sure does feel good to be here. I was real glad to not be out there, but I was not real glad to be in here. Okay, it's kind of a gray area in between. There was a woman who went to meetings a lot in Berkeley named Mary, and she did die sober. She was an older woman. She died, though, pretty much as a result of her drinking because her insides never really snapped back. I mean, there's a lot of damage after years and years of drinking. And whenever she was called on, she'd say, hello, my name is Mary, and I'm so grateful to be an alcoholic, and I love this program, and my sponsor has saved my life, and I am grateful every day for each and every one of those beautiful 12 steps. I just thought she had been out too long. I really did. I said, here is someone who has very little brain left. And whenever I talked with her, I was very patronizing. I used to treat her as if she weren't all there. Yes, Mary, I understand. But, you know, I didn't share in the gratitude at all. And because I was cool, you know. I was also only 29 years old, and she was 700, and, you know, she should have stopped drinking. My problem, when I stopped, I thought it was really unfair. You know, that I should have been able to drink till 65, which is retirement age anyway. And to be cut off short just as I was hitting my stride, you know, it felt really awful. So I was very sorry for myself and very angry, and this is unfair. I was sober a year or two, and I had moved to Los Angeles, and I went to a meeting out in the San Fernando Valley, and I sat in the back judging. And there was a guy speaking, and the only thing I remember about him was that he seemed to be a middle-aged white male. I know if I met him again, I would not recognize him, but what he said was, he said, I'm not grateful that I'm an alcoholic. And I just sat up straight in my chair. I said, there's two of us, you know? Thank God, I finally met someone, you know? And then he said, but I'm real grateful that you are. And that I remembered because that was also true for me. I wasn't grateful that I was here, but I sure was grateful you were, because you gave me a place to come to that was safe, and you gave me a place to come to where I could be just nuts. And I was very, very tense and manicky and wild and lots of emotions that were not fun to feel or observe for a long time. And you just let me keep coming back. It was gracious of you to do that. And then if I could be grateful for your being here little by little, I could be grateful for my being here. I was around 3 years clean and sober before I unclenched my jaw. That's true. I was afraid that if I let go, I'd get drunk. I mean, I was just so... Someone said, what do you do for a good time, Tom? I said, go to meetings! They said, I mean, don't you ever, like, go to a movie or go bowling or fishing? I go, no, I'd get drunk. Well... The day will come, you know, with any luck at all. I've been given lots of tools to use in the program, and I guess I'd like to talk about those this morning. The danger of speaking at a conference like this for me is that I will get theoretical and tell you what it all means. Now, the danger with that is the thing that's true is my own experience, and I can tell you what I've done and what I haven't done, but I mean that there's all, you know, let me tell you what it really means. No, okay, pull back. I was headed in that direction. Sponsor time. I was sober a couple of months, and people kept saying, do you have a sponsor? I'm a people pleaser, so I got one. The reason I got one was so I could say, yes, I have a sponsor. then they'd get off my case. What they didn't do was say what you did with your sponsor once you got him. You know? I mean, do you move in? Is this dad, you see? Do you pay his bills? Does he pay yours? I mean, a lot of funny sponsor-sponsee relationships get worked out. So I went to meetings to hear how people talked about it, and this is what I heard. You look around for a long time to find someone who is a combination of Jesus Christ and the Renaissance man. Then you say, will you be my sponsor, when you get his phone number, and you put the phone number in your book, and you put the book in the top drawer. And then you wait. And you wait until there's a crisis. And then you wait until about 3 in the morning. And then you call, and you say, hi, remember me? 6 months ago, I asked you to be my sponsor, and I'm having this crisis, and it's 3 a.m. Now, your sponsor is supposed to be grateful you called. Remember you vividly. Oh, sure, I know who you are. You're the one with the wild eyes. And then your sponsor is supposed to listen patiently to what you have to say, especially if you're swearing a lot and insulting him and condemning the program for not working. And then he's supposed to give you advice, what you're to write down. That's why you want to keep a pad and crayons by the phone. So you can write this down. Now, you don't have to do it. Instead, take that piece of paper to your home group meeting and read it to the group. Say, I called my sponsor and my sponsor said. Then the topic for the discussion is, whose sponsor is the biggest creep? You mean your sponsor makes you go to meetings? That's awful, you know. Where's freedom and stuff and dignity in the program? And that's how I fully expected this to work, and I was having problems. Now, what were the problems? The problem was, like my arms and legs, I was starting to experience sensation. And a lot of it was emotional. I hadn't felt an emotion in a long, long time. That's not quite true. I felt emotions that fit right in here, you know, just in a tiny little space. And the great emotional life that's out here, I just had divorced myself from. But as I withdrew from drugs and alcohol, my space of emotions got bigger and bigger and bigger, and I started feeling things that I had never felt before. And I concluded I was going crazy. Because I was, you know, something sad would happen, and I'd get sad. I must be going crazy. I remember traveling down the road one day, and when I was drinking, I never listened to country western music, but I lived country western music. I didn't listen to it. But then I was listening to, I just love all these great songs of it's 3 in the morning and I'm drunk and alone and who cares and let's have another beer and, you know, put that in 12 varieties. But I was listening to one of these schlocky songs about a little girl and truck drivers and I just burst into tears. And I knew I was losing it. You know, this is... Or something would happen and I'd feel angry. Just this rage would come up. And I never responded like that before. Or something would happen and I'd feel fear. And I'd say, good heavens, I'm really out of control here. So I called my sponsor to explain all this. And he said, what step are you on? What step am I on? What is he talking about? See, what I was doing was I was following what I heard at my first meeting. After I was done sharing my little story, and they clapped, a man next to me said, who'd just been out of prison for 10 days, got sober there, he said, we here in Alcoholics Anonymous go to lots of meetings. We don't drink in between meetings. And we don't use no dope. Which I really didn't know. I had been smoking non-habit-forming marijuana every day for 7 years. Especially when I wasn't drinking. I mean, how else do you take the edge off, you know? And as far as pills, I've maybe taken a dozen Valium in my life, and all of those I stole, so I really don't think that counts. That became my program. I went to a lot of meetings, I didn't drink, and I didn't use. Now, if you go to a lot of meetings, don't drink and don't use, period, you become, in a short period of time, what the other program refers to as stark raving sober. You know, people start saying things to you like, you were a lot easier to live with when you were drunk all the time, waving the gun around the room. For your birthday, your children give you booze. please use something. Well, you haven't laughed since you've stopped drinking. There's nothing to laugh at. Sobriety is a serious business. All right. And as you know, our motto is heavy does it. No, just heavy does it. Heavy. So when James said, what step are you on? What I was going to say was, I'm going to a lot of meetings, I'm not drinking in between meetings, and I'm not using no dope. That's the step I'm on. But, you can't say that. So I said, well, I guess I'm on step one. Which, as a matter of fact, I was. I mean, but I didn't know that. And we were on the phone, and he said, well, what does step one say?
What does it say?
You mean he doesn't know, you know? I mean, I knew he didn't get out of college, but still, you know. And I was a graduate student, so. So I've got my little teacher's voice, and I said, well, step one, I opened the book. This was on the phone, 3 a.m. I said, step one says that I admitted I was powerless over alcohol and my life had become unmanageable. He said, no, it doesn't. I think I was in the 37th grade by this time, and I had some teachers who wanted you to reword things, you know, especially in education classes. How does this feel to you? What color does the fifth step remind you of? Deep stuff. And so I said, all right, he wants me to reword it. And I said, all right, step one says that I acknowledged that I had no control over booze and dope and that my life had become a real mess. That's what it says. He said, no, it doesn't. I said, James, what does it say? And he says, if you look real carefully at the 12 steps, nowhere in there does the word I appear. He said, we admitted, we came to believe, we made a decision, we humbly asked, we sought through prayer, and having had a spiritual awakening, we. He said, Tom, if you're ever going to get well, you're going to have to leave your room and join the group. I hate that. I still hate that. It's one of my most unfavorite things about the program. When I became 10 years clean and sober, I really had a day there where I thought that my picture should go up next to Bob and Bill. And, you know, I have sponsored people. I have a sponsor. I've read the book. I have gone to meetings, and I've even given retreats for people in recovery. I shouldn't have to go to meetings anymore because part of me vibrates real strongly with the image of the Marlboro Man. Where, you know, when things get tough, you hop on your horse and ride off to the High Sierras and smoke cigarettes until it gets clear. Someone explained to me that the horse was his relationship. I like that. There's a program for that, too. Anyway, James told me that if I was going to get well, I'd have to start taking my horse to meetings. Again, I mean, and not just showing up, but actually participating. It's one of my brothers, quote-unquote, tried AA. You know, he went to 3 meetings. It's like trying therapy. Oh, I went once. Yeah, no good for me. When I left Berkeley, I was a year sober. I was supposed to be ordained a priest at the end of that year. I'd been in the order for, you know, 12 or 13 years, and my class was being ordained, and my ordination was held up because someone told them, and we all know who they are, that you shouldn't make a major change in your life for your first year sober. And so they said, we're going to delay you. Now, when you're clean and sober a year, if you'd still like to do this, it's fine with us. But right now, no. That hurt tremendously. It just hurt tremendously. And one of the voices I loved last night when Paul mentioned the voices, I Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, you know, is only two. I also had a very bad case of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And I never knew which one would come out, you know, sneezy or dopey or doc, you know, hi, gays, or grumpy. So, or Snow White on occasion. So, let's go back now. We got distracted. That last drink connected brain tubes that shouldn't be connected. I'm convinced of it. Gone. Oh, being held up for ordination. That was it. Anyway, you just have to go back. You'll find it. See, now, that's a real change in my behavior. There was a time when I would not have been able to go back. See, I just would have kept right on going, you know, whoop, right up, retrace your steps. When I was held up, it really felt like a rejection. And one of those voices said, they don't think you're ever going to get well. They have no hope in you. Them, you're doomed, you're isolated. I felt in tremendous pain from the rejection of it. It felt like a rejection. And the only place I found solace was at Alcoholics Anonymous, where I could go and feel the pain. And what the folks there said was, Tom, you get to hurt. You just get to hurt. And talk about it. But don't run from it. You get to hurt. Well, I left Berkeley because school was over and it's time to go back to work. And I went back to the classroom and it was like I had never been there before. It was terrifying to me. That whole first year back in the classroom sober was constant fear and constant anxiety. And the only thing I could do was teach all day long and then prepare my classes and bolt some food down and go to a meeting. And that was every day. And I said, you know, where are the promises? You know, I had no social life whatsoever my second year of sobriety. I was just terrified and nuts. And the only place that took the edge off was Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to a lot of meetings. But leaving Berkeley for L.A. was scary. Because Berkeley AA, first of all, wasn't big then. Now we have a fellowship and a lot of folks hanging out doing stuff. But a big meeting was 30 people. And that was a Wednesday night meeting. And we had one meeting a night in town. So if it was Tuesday night, you didn't have to figure out, where are we going tonight? You went there. And if you went to 5 or 8 meetings a week, within a couple of weeks, you knew the fellowship. And it was a real sense. It was like a small town. I went to L.A., and there were 1,000 meetings a week. In places I'd never heard of before, you see. And one of the first ones I went to was on Sunday night on the corner of Wilshire and Normandy, where 500 of our closest friends got together and clapped every other minute for a lot of things. I had never experienced people clapping at an AA meeting before, because in Berkeley we thought that was uncool. We nodded if something really went well, and we just didn't explode into this emotionalism. And I knew they used the same 12 steps and followed the same 12 traditions, but when I moved down to Southern California, I thought I was with a bunch of religious fanatics, applauding and cheering and bursting into tears and, oh, thank God, and wearing dark glasses a lot. I just didn't know, you know, how it was very hard to readjust. Before I left Berkeley, I wrote the Cardinal, and I said, I'm coming into L.A. I'll be ordained sometime next year. I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And is there a priest anywhere in the Archdiocese who's sober I could talk to? And he wrote back and said, call Terry R. You know him. He's a very desperately ill man, you know. So I got to L.A. on a Friday and went to a meeting Friday night, 2 on Saturday, 2 on Sunday, and called him Monday morning. And I said, now, I didn't know anything about him. I didn't know what he looked like. I didn't know what he thought about crucial issues of our day. I didn't know who he voted for. I mean, I knew nothing that was important about him, except that he was also a priest and he was also in recovery. And I called him and said, hi, I'm Tom Weston, and I'm just over a year sober now, and I need a sponsor. Will you be it? And he said, how long have you been in town? I said, since Friday. He said, been to any meetings? I said, 5. He said, I'll be your sponsor. And then we began this dance, you know. I mean, he said, oh, this is a Monday. And he has his favorite meeting is on Monday night in downtown L.A. called the White Flag Men's Stag. Dreariest meeting I have ever been to in my life. Well, as you know, a room full of men is pretty dull to start with, but this was, you know, Terry's friends. And they all thought he was wonderful. So I showed up there, and we started going to this meeting every Monday night, and he'd pick me up. Now, I'm going to the meeting, but I'm checking Terry out the whole time because I don't know anything about him yet. So you throw out a topic, see how he responds. I watched how he handled other people, and he seemed to handle real crazy folk pretty well. So I thought that was important. It didn't occur to me that he was doing exactly the same thing with me. And I was there a bit, and I said, I need to do a fourth and fifth step. And he said, you sure do, you know. He's not a pushy person. He's only forbidden me to do one thing, just cold, you know, which I don't have to get into here tonight. But he... So I started this fourth step, and I wrote about resentments, and I wrote about fears, and I wrote about sexual stuff, and I wrote about finances pretty much along the book, which was a surprise to me. I didn't know that was in the book. And because I'm so busy, I just didn't have time to read it. And I said, well, let's set a date and do this fifth step. And he said, fine. And I said, I hope to be done middle of August. He said, I'll be there. So we got a time and a date, and I finished my fifth step, and I read it to him. Now, the step says we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. It doesn't say your sponsor, because some sponsors don't qualify, as you know. But I wanted to do it with my sponsor. And the reason was because I didn't trust anybody. I mean, I really didn't trust anybody. And I had to learn how to do this. And again, I didn't know I was doing this at the time, but looking back, it's very clear. I did a fifth step with him to talk about the exact nature of my wrongs so that he would know who I am. And it was kind of a real jump in the dark because I didn't know really how he'd feel about some of my better ideas because they had never come up in conversation. My fear, as we were doing the fifth step, I read it to him. I admitted to God, myself, on the floor, the exact nature of my wrongs, and Terry happened to be in the room. And I went through the list of stuff, and on one occasion I had to clarify one item that was a little ambiguous, so I clarified it and went on, and I was done. No response from him. He's an introvert, and they tend to think to themselves, I think out loud, he thinks, and he rocked back and forth for a few moments, which he does very well, and then he said, one thing's real clear. Now, I don't like people for whom one thing is real clear because I've always thought they were superior to me because for me, not very much is clear, you know. It's all this part of the cosmic dance and gray to me. But he clearly had some ideas and he kind of hunched over and, which he also does very well, he said, both you and I need this program very much. And he got up and left the room. I was thrilled to see him go. Now, I did not feel this huge spiritual rush. All I knew is if I went to a meeting that day, which he recommended he may have, I don't know, I was so numb. He said, I'd go to a meeting and I'm not going to drink today. And, you know, when people said, what's up? I'll say, I just did my fifth step. Fine. Very businesslike. I was very businesslike about this. But I did not call him the next day. And the reason was because I was afraid to. See, I didn't know if I could trust him yet. Because when I trust somebody, it means I need to be able to tell them whatever's going on, knowing that A, they will not run from me, and B, they will not run to me. You know, say, oh, here, let me fix you. See, he practices a pretty good Al-Anon program. And I was afraid I'd call and say, hi, this is Tom, remember me, we talked yesterday, let's get together. And he'd say something like, I don't sponsor psychopaths. Or, does the Archbishop know about this last scam? You know. So I didn't call him. He didn't call me because he's an introvert, and they don't call. So the next time, and he wanted to give me space. He is a Californian. So I didn't see him at all, and I stopped going to his Monday night meeting because it was such a dreary bunch of people. And besides, he was there. And the next time I saw him was by mistake. Rabbi Magnin was the chief rabbi at the Wilshire Boulevard Temple, and every year he, before Passover, he would have an ecumenical spiritual service running through the Passover ritual for clergy who were not Jewish. And I was invited, and Terry was invited independently, and I showed up, and he showed up, and we were all there celebrating the Feast of, going into a celebration of the Feast of Passover, which is a celebration of the March from Slavery to Freedom kind of program. And I looked across the room, and there he was, my sponsor. So I wandered over to him, and I said, how you doing? He said, okay, how you been? I said, want to get together? He said, sure, let's have coffee. And it was like everything was okay. Now, that at that point, I was 2.5 years on the program, 10 zillion meetings later, having done a fourth and fifth step, met a lot of people, and it occurred to me that night that I have finally found someone I trusted. I think I was real fast. Because I know people on the program who have been around a lot longer who haven't found that person yet. And I'm very grateful for that. And if I can trust one person, I can start trusting more than one person. And I can start trusting whole rooms full of people. And I found that my world, since my fourth and fifth step, has become an awful lot safer for me. Not immediately. But I noticed that after I did my fifth step, within 6 months or so, I was laughing more frequently. I was measurably happier, which was kind of a big surprise to me. He's still my sponsor. We still keep in pretty close contact. And for now almost 11 years, it's really a powerful experience for me to have a person who knows me real well and who has helped me walk through real craziness, and I just didn't know how to do it without him. I think that's one of the real rewards of recovery for me. What else is true? The hardest step for me in recovery was not 4 and 5. 4 and 5 were just inconvenient, you know. I think we make them into the hardest steps. I think that there is self-fulfilling prophecy. And I think when we get newcomers and sit them down and say, now your fourth and fifth step will be an excruciating experience. It'll take 10 years to do. They take 10 years to do it, and it becomes an excruciating experience. If we sat them down and said, listen, it's no big deal. Get it done tonight and bring it to me tomorrow and we'll get this through. They'd do it. You know? I mean, it's very strange how that works. The hardest step for me has been step 2. Which brings up this God business. I think, and this is an opinion, but I am right. I think that a lot of people go into psychiatry and psychology because they wonder if they themselves are crazy. And I think that's true. And I think a lot of people go into ministry because they have problems with God. Now, that's a suspicion of mine. But I sure have. And I bump into folks who find it amazing that a priest could have problems with God. I mean, I think most of us do. You know, well, it's part of being flesh and blood, I think. My problems may be different from your problems, and I'm going to talk just about mine. And my problem with God is this. I've always believed in a God. Now, we weren't always speaking. You know, but I always knew there was a God there, and what I believed about God was good stuff. I was taught, and I went through Catholic schooling, I was taught that God was loving, compassionate, generous, and wonderful. Sometimes I think I'm the only Roman Catholic in North America that was in that class. God, I mean, and I believe that. I believe that God was absolutely wonderful, but then my alcoholism steps in and changes it just a little, and I concluded that God was fabulous for you, but somehow didn't work for me. See, that's the difference. Whereas I'm sure that if you jump, there is someone to catch you. I'm not so sure that if I jump, there is someone to catch me. This is called arrogance. There are two kinds of arrogance. One is the kind that says, I'm a lot better than you, you're garbage. Therefore, we have nothing in common, and the rules that apply to you do not apply to me, and I'm different and alone and isolated in my room. Okay? That's not my kind of arrogance. My kind of arrogance is kind number two, which says, I'm worse than all of you. And therefore, the rules that apply to you don't apply to me, and we have nothing in common, and I'm alone and isolated in my room. I mean, the results are exactly the same, but the starting off place is different. And I knew that if you went to meetings and trusted and worked steps, God's grace would work wonders in your life. It just wouldn't happen for me. Which brings up this question of conscious context. See, I don't feel God's presence. That kind of, you know, God is the big pharmacy in the sky, you know. If you're connected with God, you kind of got a little high, you buzz. That's not part of my usual experience. It's happened once or twice, you know, usually after a few social drinks. But most of my experience with God is a consciousness one. See, I'm conscious of God's presence. I'm aware of it often, but I don't feel it. One of the stories that makes a tremendous difference to me is it's the old Genesis story of Abraham. This is Sunday morning. Abraham, according to the story, Abraham is 75 years old and pretty well off and pretty well established in this town. And he has a house and goats and cows and sheep and avocados. His wife, Sarah, is about 70, and they've been together for a long time, and they have no kids, and they're hanging out. And one day, strangers come in off the desert, and it's very clear in the scripture that these strangers somehow are God, you know, whatever God is, but it's there. And they chat and talk, and Abraham says, you know, let Sarah cook for you, like men do. Go ahead, work. Then, of course, he said, we fed them, you know, but anyway, she did the work. Interesting. And they share back and forth, and the strangers say, listen, Abraham, I want you to leave everything you know and everything you're familiar with and your family here. Leave the town. I want you to go to a place you've never been to before. When you get there, they are not going to like you. In fact, they're going to try to kill you. They don't speak your language, and it's going to be very hostile and scary for years, and they do not take Visa card, and we'd like you to leave this afternoon. Now, see, I don't think... Oh, they said, and by the way, next year we're going to come back to visit, and Sarah is going to give you a son by you. You see? Now, I think Abraham's first thought, although this is not recorded, was, I'm going to be 90 years old with a 15-year-old in the house. That was his first thought. And I don't think that Abraham necessarily took all this as good news. He went to tell Sarah, and he said, we have to leave. Start packing, please. I'll be out here. We're leaving. We're going to go to this new country. We've never been there before. And they're likely to kill us and be very dangerous. And by the way, you're going to get pregnant, and next year we're going to have a little boy. And Sarah laughed so hard that she had to sit down, so they named their son Isaac, which meant she laughed so hard she had to sit down. Now, see, I relate some to the story because coming into sobriety is a lot like that for me. I'm not one of those people who say, oh, hooray, it's clearly God's will, let's go. I become afraid of leaving the familiar, even though it's awful, but it's mine. And going off to this new land. Now, I know you can do it and God will take care of you, but I don't think God will take care of me. And sobriety has been just like that. Leave a world you're real familiar with, that's absolute despair, and come into a world where there's hope and light and a lot of laughter. And my first response is, it won't happen for me. Well, try it anyway. Just jump. So faith for me is a lot like the... I mean, I'm not real willing to go all the time. I tried to explain this to my sponsor. And I have to use small words and repeat myself a lot to get the point across to him. And he says, oh yeah, he said, I've always thought that faith is like going into a dark room. Now, you can't see what's there, but this voice says, hey, come on in. Trust me. Trust who? Listen, I'm more than willing to come in, but can you give me a few guarantees? You know? And the response is, no, just trust me. Come on in, and I can ease into the room. When I think of my relationship with God, I mean, on a real, real good day, I'm resting in the palm of God's hand, which is kind of nice, but that's rare. My usual vision is tug of war over a bottomless pit. Or Indian wrestling, you know, me and God, and me, and every so often I win. You know, oh great, now what do we do? Well, wait for the next challenge, you know, and... Nikos Kantzenzakis is a Greek writer who wrote Zorba the Greek and a few other things, and in an autobiography of his called Report to Greco, he writes about when he was a very young boy, in his late teens, early 20s. You can tell how old I am, a very young boy, late teens, early 20s. And he was filled with fervor and zeal. He was Greek Orthodox, and he wanted a lot of answers and everything in 25 words or less and clarity, and what does it all mean after all. So he went to the holiest place in Greece, Mount Athos, and he went to the oldest monastery, and in the oldest monastery he went to the oldest monk, and he sat the oldest monk down and he said, tell me what it all means. And the old monk said, well, if I had to divide my life in half, I'd say in the first half I spent it wrestling with the devil. And Kantzenzakis said, what happened? And the old man said, I won. And Kantzenzakis said, well, what about the second half? And the old man said, I've been wrestling with God. And Kantzenzakis said, why? And the old man said, because I hope I'll lose. That makes tremendous sense to me. Tremendous sense to me. And the biggest breakthrough for me was when I could do the second step. You know? Well, I don't believe in the second step 100%. You don't have to. If you believe in it 8%, do it. And I was waiting for it to happen to me.
I'll just wait for the second step to take place. No.
I had to say out loud and pray out loud that, God, I really do believe you're there, and I really do believe that if I jump, you can catch me, and I really do believe that even I, as hard and as cold and as shut down as I am, even I can be restored to sanity. Even I can get to a place where I can work and I can love and I can play and I can lead a human life. The rules that apply to you apply to me. That's my statement of faith. So I had to make a statement of faith in me before I could make a statement of faith in God. And then once I could do, and I, there are times I still am not quite sure of that second step. It's 50-50. I know. And I went to a meeting in Berkeley and I looked around the room and had a spiritual awakening. And the awakening was that I noticed that I was not the only person in the room. Number two, the second thing, and it maybe happened 10 minutes later or 10 months later, I don't know, I'm not good on time, but it occurred to me that everybody in the room had a right to be there. I was in the room. I had a right to be there too. And the third spiritual awakening, either 10 minutes or 10 months later, again, I don't know, was I realized that everybody in the room has equal access to God. You know? And that's why we write about we. You know? That's why we can write about we. And I was so desperate about a year ago, I was actually reading the book. Which is pretty desperate. You talk to your sponsor's machine and it didn't help. And it's on page 573, appendix 4. I mean, this is desperate, you know. The Lasker Award, and the Lasker Award says here that they're really thrilled about AA because This is a great venture in social pioneering which forged a new instrument for social action, a new therapy based on the kinship of common suffering. The reason I have hope is because you've been there before me. I was in a Catholic circus in L.A. a couple months ago. 15,000 Catholics running around in habits and Roman collars and talking about God a lot, can you imagine? And I was talking to a priest from back east who was not on the program, but he's very friendly towards us, and he says, "Tom, you know, I'm thrilled at the 12-step programs, and I have a great amount of respect for the secret of AA." Now, can I say, I should have just nodded my head and say, "Oh, yes," but I didn't know what he was talking about. And my sponsor says, "When you don't know, ask questions," which gets you embarrassed sometimes. And I said, what secret are we talking about? He says, "Oh, you know." He says, "The one where you all get together and admit you're all broken. But it's just that some of you have been at this longer. And that's how you give each other hope. You know, we're all broken. But some of us have been at this longer, and we know a few things." As it was explained to me in Berkeley, the reason AA works is because we're not all crazy on the same day. I want to end with my favorite story because it's late and, you know, we got to get home. To our moms. A few years ago, I took some classes in Berkeley from the Orthodox rabbi of Berkeley, who was no raving liberal, believe me. He was lots of rules and regulations and very rich in his own, a wonderful teacher, a very spiritual man. And it was a class in Jewish theology for people who were born Jewish but had never done anything about it. So it was roots time, or people who were converting, and then there was me. And he knew I was a Catholic priest, and we talked shop a couple times, which was, I built my ego tremendously. This was a fine, fine scholar. And on one occasion, someone raised their hand and said, "Rabbi, what is a blessing?" "What's a blessing, Rabbi?" And I don't know what you know about rabbis, but rabbis traditionally do not give direct answers. You know, because if you do, people don't think. They just say, "Oh." You say, but you got to kind of get people to think. So, whenever possible, a rabbi will answer a question by asking a question. Is it like, "Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar?" A good rabbi would say, "Whose picture's on the coin?" "Caesar's. Give it to him. Next." You know? So there we were in Berkeley watching this. And if you can't, you know, "Rabbi, what is the greatest commandment?" There are 10 commandments, 613 laws. If you pick one, you're going to make everyone else angry. You know, which one's the greatest? And a good rabbi said, "You're a lawyer. How do you read it?" "Well, you're to love the Lord your God with all your heart and strength and mind and soul, and your neighbor as yourself." As it was explained to me in theology, the problem with loving our neighbor as ourselves is that most of us do. You know, and we mix that up with honesty. It's just self-hatred, you know, and beat up the world. Anyway, text resumed. When you can't, and then the neighbor, the lawyer says, "Well, who's my neighbor?" If you can't answer with the question, you tell a story. A man is going on the road to Jericho and gets beaten up by robbers. Okay, so that's the style. So in Berkeley, that's what happened. This woman raised her hand and said, "Rabbi, what is a blessing?" And the rabbi stopped and fooled with his beard, which is why we have beards. And he said, "When God created the world, God created the world in 6 days. And at the end of each day of creation, God looked at what God had made and said, 'This is good. This is good.' So God creates the dry land and says it's good, and the sun and the moon and the stars and says it's good, and fish and goats and avocados and says they're good. And on the 6th day, God creates the human being and doesn't say anything." And the rabbi said, "Any conclusions?" And someone said, people are no good. And the rabbi said, that's a possible conclusion. He said, and that's why it's a bad translation. He said, in English, good means too many things. You have a good book, the good book, a good person, have a good day, for a good time, call good. You know, means a lot of very strange things. He said, in Hebrew, and then he looked over at me and said, which is what God spoke. God looked at what God had made and said, this is Tov, T-O-V, Tov. He said, what does Tov mean? He says, Tov means it's complete. Tov means it's whole. Tov means it's entire. Tov means it's exactly the way it's supposed to be. It can't be any different. The earth and cows and goats and avocados are Tov. But he said, people aren't created complete. People are not created entire. We're created empty and with a lot of empty places. So what are we supposed to do in the course of a lifetime? We're supposed to fill in some of the empty places. We're supposed to become bigger. We're born male, we're supposed to become men. We're born female, we're supposed to become women. We're born male, female, we're supposed to become humans. And it takes time, and it takes work, and it takes effort, and it just doesn't happen by you sitting there. And he said, as you're going along your journey, as you're on your path, as you're trudging the road, you know, anything that gets behind you and pushes you forward, anything that gets ahead of you and drags you into the next scene, anything that gets down deep inside of you where it's dark and cold and brittle and narrow and kicks and shoves and pushes until suddenly there's more room, the rabbi said, anything that does that is a blessing. And he said, sometimes blessings don't feel very good. And sometimes we don't know their blessings till years later. And you look back on a situation that you knew was going to kill you. And instead it opened up whole rooms that you never even knew were there. When the rabbi said that, it occurred to me why alcoholism, which was a curse, because of you and 12 steps and the higher power, has become for me a very rich blessing, full of life and pain and joy and grief and humanity. And I've learned that from you, and for that I'm grateful. Thank you.